Georgia's DBHDD is urging people to ask a pharmacist about getting naloxone for their first aid kits at home or work. No prescription is needed. Naloxone can rapidly reverse an opioid overdose and restore breathing. Opioidresponse.info.
Thanks for listening to the Political Rewind podcast. Be sure to like and follow us and rate us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to another edition of Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut and am very happy to have all of you with us, as I always am, for this edition of Political Rewind. You know, it's become a tradition, an annual tradition on this show, usually at the very start of a legislative session, to have the Speaker of the House, David Ralston, talk with us. And we're going to talk with Speaker Ralston today. Jim Galloway, a former political columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, is going to join me for that conversation. But Speaker Ralston, we're very happy to have you with us. And I think I'm right that you're basically in your 30th year of serving in the Georgia General Assembly. You started, I think, in the, 92 session? You were elected to the state Senate and then have served. You served in the House, Fannin, Gilmer, a portion of Dawson counties in the late 90s, and except for a run at one point for Attorney General, you've been there straight through, right?
Well, 26 years to be exact, if anybody's counting.
Okay.
So I'm not quite to 30 yet, yeah, I was 6 years in the Senate back in the 90s, and I came to the House and elected in 02 and been here since.
Okay, well, I'm not trying to age you, Mr. Speaker, so thank you for that. you're going to get do enough aging during this session, I suspect. Jim Galloway, thank you for being here with us today as well. How are you, Jim?
I'm doing great. I'm happy to be here.
You and I will exchange opportunities. Yeah, it's always fun to have Speaker Ralston on, and you and I will go back and forth and ask questions of the Speaker. And Mr. Speaker, I would like to start with what I think is the most obviously political question that you'll probably be asked during this show. But a lot of the conversation will flow out of your what you have to say about this. On the day of the State of the State speech, I don't have the exact transcript in front of me, but I think it's fair to say that your introduction of Governor Kemp was about as effusive as it could possibly have been. You complimented him on the great job you said he has done during his tenure as governor, and you said something to the effect of, "I can't imagine how anyone could do it better." Should we interpret that as your first nod toward endorsing Brian Kemp in his primary campaign against David Perdue?
Well, you know, endorsements are not really on my mind right now. I do think Governor Kemp has done a very good job on managing through the pandemic, minimizing the amount of time that we as a state were locked down, emphasizing getting businesses reopened and kids back in school. That was a tough time, as you guys will remember. And I thought he handled that quite well. He's had other challenges, and you know, let's be candid. One of the challenges that he's had to deal with is this looming dark cloud of the former president's repeated rhetoric about him, and that can't make doing the job any easier.
So given that, and given that David Perdue has been one of the most prominent supporters of what's come to be known as the big lie, do you wish David Perdue had stayed out of this race? Is he causing trouble for Republicans by entering this contest?
Well, it's a free country, and I mean, he's free to run as is any Georgian. I'm trying to understand his rationale. You know, a rationale that says, you know, we're divided and I'm going to unify us by further dividing us. I'm not sure. I'm sure that there is a deep meaning there that I'm not grasping yet. So I'm trying to get my brain wrapped around what the rationale is for running. Look, I mean, we've talked about this before. We're in a very competitive political environment in Georgia. I don't remember an environment in my time here this competitive between the two parties. I don't even think, and I would defer to both of you, and particularly Galloway, who was covering 02 politics and the period there, right after that. First of all, it was a much less toxic environment nationally, and it kind of hit us quickly, and then it was gone, and so. But we're in a toxic environment now, and I think we have to understand that that's a part of where we are. But at the end of the day, somebody's going to be nominated by the Republican Party in May, or if there's a runoff, I guess June, July. And then they're going to run against Stacey Abrams in November. So the other question I would have is, how does a primary challenge help us as a party unify, conserve resources, and do all the things that we need to do to get ready for what will be a very challenging race in November? So those are a couple of concerns that I have about his campaign.
Mr. Speaker,
now, having said all of that, Bill, I'm not endorsing anybody.
Well, it sounds sounds like you're pretty darn close, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, if I could, how is this primary contest affecting members of the House Republican Caucus? Because a governor has incredible power. Especially when it comes to the state budget and the line item veto, it just seems to me that this has put your members in a very, very tough spot.
Jim, I would beg to differ a little bit. First of all, I don't really hear a lot of discussion about the primary amongst our caucus members. To the extent that I do, the conversation is sort of raising some of the questions I've raised this morning as to the, why and how does this impact us going forward. I think there is some concern about that. I haven't polled our caucus. I don't intend to poll the caucus. I suspect they are fairly overwhelmingly, supporting Governor Kemp in the primary. It's been less of a distraction than you would think, frankly, and which I'm happy for. I think it's really been a much lower level discussion than I had thought initially it might be.
But Mr. Speaker, while there may not be a lot of talk among members about it, certainly the legislation that's being introduced on both sides, the House and the Senate, some of it is a very direct appeal by candidates, GOP primary candidates, to that Trump base. And I think clearly one of the biggest examples of that would be this push that's being made by some members to ban critical race theory. I know that you want to talk. You have a very positive agenda, and I do want to give you a chance to talk about it because I think it's important. But I also think people would love to hear your take on, say, the banning of critical race theory, which you know, certainly, is not taught in Georgia schools. And if it's not being taught in Georgia schools, what is critical race theory really standing in for in terms of discussions of the history of race in this state and country?
Well, Bill, you know as well as I do that the fact that something is not an actual problem has never stood in the way of it becoming an issue in this General Assembly. And I've dealt with that on a number of occasions. I suspect before I go back to the mountains, I'll have to deal with it again. You know, here's the way I look at the critical race theory discussion. First of all, and I thought, you know, Governor Youngkin in Virginia made a great point the other day. I was watching an interview by him. He said, you know, what people have to understand, first of all, you don't sign up for a class in high school or college on critical race theory. I mean, it's not a distinct, separate class that a student can take. I think the important thing about critical race theory is it really is tied up into the whole issue of parental control and how much influence parents have over their children's education, whether it's curriculum, whether it's books through the obscene books or obscene literature issue that's out there. Parents have felt like, and these are parents in rural Georgia, suburban Georgia, and even I've heard from some in urban Georgia that believe that they have been sort of excluded and now they're no longer welcome into the educational decision-making process. So critical race theory's relevance, I think, is more in terms of being a part of that discussion than it is being a standalone issue.
If that's the case, Mr. Speaker, how much authority do you give parents in determining curriculum without it becoming something close to chaos? If you've got 2,000 students in a high school, you've got 4,000 parents or something close to that. Do they get veto power? How does that authority come into being within a school system?
Well, I think first of all, they need to be heard. They feel like they're not being heard at all now, and there needs to be some guarantees that their views will be not just heard but considered and become part of the process. Frankly, if we don't do something about this, then you're going to have a lot of people who are going to feel that chaos is preferable to a slammed door. And that's kind of the feeling by a lot of parents now. I mean, look, you know, we heard for a year that Virginia was not just purple but blue, and who was it that elected Glenn Youngkin? It wasn't a huge outpouring of rural conservative voters that had followed Donald Trump. It was suburban voters, suburban mothers, elected Youngkin governor of Virginia. These are educated, bright people who just want a voice and a place at the table, in their kids' schooling.
Are we talking more than school board elections in this sense?
Well, I think we're talking about the school board elections, but we are talking about more than that. We're talking about school board meetings. We're talking about the general receptiveness by administrators and professionals in our schools to the views of parents. Sometimes people just want to be heard, and they want to know that their views count for something, whether they're whether they're embraced quickly or not is not so much the issue. And right now, there seems to be a growing feeling out there that their views are not welcomed. And their input is not received, and I think that's a problem.
Mr. Speaker, I want to parse something you said and be sure I didn't mishear it. When I asked you about critical race theory, I thought it was informative that you said that you know this isn't the first time that there's been an issue in search of a problem. But you managed to work into that answer the notion, Jan Jones, your Speaker Pro Tem's measure, which would ban so-called obscene materials from schools. And I want to make sure I heard that right. It sounds to me like if critical race theory gains momentum at all in the House, you're not going to be terribly supportive of that ban, but that you think the obscene materials measure may be something that you'd like to see the House look at seriously.
Well, if that is in fact a problem, and I have no reason to question that it is, because I have the greatest respect for the Speaker Pro Tem, and I know that she is she's our go-to person on educational issues in the House, and I lean on her for that. And if she tells me we have a problem with obscene books and materials in our schools and in our libraries, I'm going to believe her. I mean that because I know that she would not. She doesn't shoot from the hip. She doesn't, go off in an intemperate way. She's very measured, I would put that in a different category for sure.
Let me add one last question from me, and then, Jim, I want to give it back to you. I want to talk about another introduction that you made. Mayor Dickens, the new mayor of Atlanta, paid a visit to the House, and you accorded him great ceremony. You allowed him or offered him the opportunity to walk down the center aisle, greeting your members as he came in, which is typically reserved for governors, Supreme Court justices, whatever. And you were pretty effusive in your praise for him, saying how important it was that he wants to mend relations with the state, which, of course, had fallen into total disrepair under Mayor Bottoms. So let me ask you, I know public safety is one of your biggest issues this session. Were you in any way signaling that you'd like to work with Mayor Dickens to solve the public safety problems that the city of that Buckhead and other parts of the city have, rather than see a secession movement move forward?
Well, I'm not. I haven't reached a judgment yet on the secession movement. However, I do want to work with Mayor Dickens. Whether it's on public safety, whether it's on transportation, whatever the issue may be. I think it's important. The city of Atlanta is important to the entire state. the entire state is important to the city of Atlanta. And, you know, when I became speaker in 2010, you know, I was reminded of a tradition that apparently had happened in the past, I think was suspended around 2002 or 4, to invite the newly elected mayor in and welcome them, as we did Mayor Dick and Jess today. And so I thought it was important to reinstate that. We did with Mayor Reed at that time. We did the same thing for Mayor Bottoms. And then we did the same thing for Mayor Dickens. You know, let me say this about Mayor Dickens. Kasim Reed had a lot of, he had spent years, some years over here in this building, both in the House and in the Senate. He had relationships here. He knew how the process here worked. Mayor Bottoms did not have that same background, and I think that was probably, in terms of the city-state relationship, was probably detrimental. And Mayor Dickens doesn't have that. But here is what I get from him. He wants to he wants to have dialogue. He wants to have a relationship with the members of the House and the members of the Senate, and all of the people here at the Capitol, because he gets how important that is. I mean, this guy came to see me before he got elected. He called me at 7:30 in the morning after he had been elected, and said, "Well, you know, why are you calling me? You ought to be on a plane headed for the Caribbean to rest." But you know, he brings great energy. He brings great positivity. I think he recognizes what the problems are with, whether it's with Buckhead City or other areas in Atlanta. I'm expecting, him to be a really great mayor, frankly.
Let me ask you, Mr. Speaker. Yeah, Mr. Speaker, if you're not ready to say yay or nay on city of Buckhead legislation, is it worth considering changing state law so that everyone in an entity that's being affected gets a vote? I think there's a bill that's been introduced to that effect. I mean, under the current law, only residents of Buckhead would get that vote if it were put up for a referendum, even though it would affect the city of Atlanta as a whole.
Yeah, Jim, I'm open to having that discussion, but I will tell you that my strong inclination is to say let's play this issue out with a set of rules that we started under. I'm not one to want to change the rules in the middle of the game. That's my inclination right now. We had a certain set of rules when we started this discussion. I think they should play out under that. That may be a conversation worth having at some point.
Mr. Speaker, we've only got a few more minutes with you. I appreciate all the time you've taken already, but I want to talk about a couple aspects, give you a chance to talk about a couple aspects of your agenda. Certainly your desire to expand mental health services is something likely to gain broad bipartisan support at a time when we're more fractured than ever in the state and the country. Tell us what your best outcome would be in terms of expanding mental health services for Georgians.
Bill, I have a hard time believing that mental health reform and innovation in how we deliver mental health care services would be a partisan, would become a partisan issue.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if that happens, shame on us. This is an issue that's not Republican or Democrat. It's not urban, rural, or suburban. It's not black or white. It's not rich or poor. I mean, this cuts across every strata of our society here in Georgia and everywhere. And it's also an issue I feel very passionate about. And we'll talk about that tomorrow at a we're going to have a little announcement tomorrow. I think that when you see the people who are going to co-sponsor the little bill I'm asking them to drop in, I think it will become evident that this is a is truly a bipartisan venture, and I'm going to. Because I kind of view this as something I feel so passionate about, I'm going to, you know, get my whip and stay on them and make sure that it continues to be.
Well, give us just a headline. Come on, give us a headline. What are you going to say? What's the headline that you're going to give us for tomorrow? Give us a preview.
I'm not sure I'm a good headline writer, or I would write better
Mr.
headlines
Speaker.
About me.
okay. All right. Well, then let's put it this way. This seems, Mr. Speaker, this seems to be kind of very much a parallel to what Governor Nathan Deal did and Doug Collins did in Washington. A good part of this is what you're trying to take mental health care. Out of the hands of law enforcement across the state, it's bogging down jails. It's bogging down personnel.
Well, law enforcement wants this out of their hands. I mean, I've talked with many, many sheriffs, including my own sheriff in Fannin County, who I have such great respect for. I asked him one day. I said, "You know, what percentage of calls coming into your department are really?" At their basics, a mental health call. His guesstimate was over 60%. And then, they take the person into the jail. Person may not have violated the law. Well, the jail's not a camp for mental health, problems. It's a place for people who have violated the law, and oftentimes they have no options then. There's nowhere in the system to put them for treatment. The family has gone as far as they can go in terms of caring for them. It becomes a real tough issue, so that's only a part of it, but this is something law enforcement wants this off their plate. We'll talk about this tomorrow. I mean, all the things that are impacted by mental health, you know, every family in Georgia almost has been impacted by this. Whether it's the tragedy of a youth suicide, whether it's... we're losing productivity in our economy. So many things are bound up in this issue that I think it may even be a step up the ladder from criminal justice reform. So to me, it's a it's there's no more important issue that we can deal with this session than mental health reform.
Mr. Speaker, we have kept you a little bit longer than our agreed upon time, and I know you've got a busy day down at the Capitol today. I'm always grateful that you come on the show and share with us your thoughts about the legislative session. I'm glad we ended with mental health, which, as you say, seems to be an issue that perhaps can get more bipartisan support than almost anything else on the calendar for the legislature this year. So thank you so much, David Ralston, for being with us. We're going to take a break. When we come back, Jim Galloway, let's you and I try to fill in a few of the blanks here that Speaker David Ralston left for us. We'll do that and a lot more. And again, Mr. Speaker, thanks for being with us, sir.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Jim.
We'll be back in a moment. Jim Galloway joins me for the rest of Political Rewind today after our long conversation with Speaker Ralston. So, Jim, Speaker Ralston is always very, very good. He's an attorney. He knows how to be careful in what he says and doesn't say. Nevertheless, I think we learned some interesting things from him today, and I want to, you know, run them past you, see if you agree with me. I asked him, was his introduction, his high praise for Brian Kemp at the State of the State speech, was it essentially an endorsement? The speaker said, well, it's, I'm not thinking about endorsements right now. But I do think he's done a great job for the state. Should David Ralston have gotten, David Perdue gotten into this race, I asked. And he said, well, I'm still trying to figure out why he would have gotten into this race. He wants to unite the party. He's just dividing it more. That's about as close to an endorsement as you're going to get out of a guy like Ralston at this stage in the process.
Right. And I think one of the more important things he said in that vein was that he's been under no pressure from members of his House Republican caucus to even contemplate the Perdue candidacy, and this isn't right. this isn't a legislature where Republicans, a certain faction of the Republican Party, have just created their own Freedom Caucus, if you will, in line with Trump, and again, yeah, I mean, it's asking a lot of any lawmaker, even a Democrat or Republican, to go again, to move against the governor overtly during a special session. There's just so many ways that can result in tragedy for an individual lawmaker. So I thought it was you're right. I thought that was an interesting an interesting revelation of really solid support for Brian Kemp in the Capitol. Not sensing any crack in that.
Yeah, I think that's right. Okay. We asked him about critical race theory. We said they don't teach critical race theory in schools here, Mr. Speaker. So why would you want to have a law that bans it? And if it's not critical race theory, what does it stand for, really? And Ralston said it's not the first time that we've seen an issue in search of a problem, meaning he's not for it. But he expanded on that. And he added to that referring to Jan Jones' bill, which would, in fact, outlaw so-called obscene materials for schools. And then when I asked him whether he could support that but not critical race theory, I think you asked him that as well, he said that's probably the direction I'm headed. That strikes me as one of the more interesting news items to come out of our conversation.
Yeah, here's a question for you. How do you tell the history of Georgia? How do you explain politics in Georgia without addressing the topic of race? Yeah. It's virtually impossible, and I think there's some recognition that this is the case. But I thought the way he turned that question he says he's trying to address what he thinks is a feeling of alienation by parents toward their local school systems, and that they want to be heard, and beyond. But past that, it gets a little foggy. The problem with banning, as we've seen, we've got decades of court cases behind us. The problem with banning obscene material or books on this topic or that topic is that they run into a fairly skeptical court system, and it's hard to write those laws so that they aren't overly broad and get tossed out on that very count.
Well, I thought he also painted a rather sanguine picture of a Democratic school board meeting. I mean, Democratic with a small d, a lowercase d, mm-hmm. in which parents on both sides of an issue would come together to collegially talk about what books should and should not be in the classrooms. And that raises really two questions. Number one is, are schools and school board meetings really places where democracy ought to operate in the first place? Or, in fact, should educators be the ones who have a vast majority of the say in what's taught in the schools?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I do believe that school boards are a place where democracy ought to take hold. It's a very fundamental principle. We do elect.
But you're not talking about a debate over what books should be taught or not, are you?
No, you want that in the hands
of parents?
No. But that's something that has to be that has to be addressed on a campaign
right.
level. But I will tell you right. that I live in Cobb County, which right now has a very dysfunctional school board. And is not operating at as it should because of the political rancor there. I think, you know, beyond how a parent would impact a school curriculum, I think that's a very touchy issue. You're absolutely right. Should you have parents deciding what books are allowed in a school library or not? There are parents who I would trust wonderfully with that task. There are other parents that I would say no way.
He cited Virginia Governor Youngkin several times in his campaign, which of course turned on giving parents more involvement, more control over some aspects of the state's education system. And of course, Youngkin singled out as an example of obscene materials that were taught in some advanced level English classes in Virginia, Toni Morrison's novel, Beloved, which is mm-hmm. one of the most extraordinary novels of the 20th century. She won a Pulitzer Prize. It has been acclaimed for years. It's a very, very searing look at what happened to enslaved people in a very personal way. But the notion that that book should be held up, and it will be again in Georgia, no doubt, as an example of a book that ought to be banned, is one that I think most academics who specialize in English literature would fight back against very, very hard.
Oh, absolutely, and part of me says that the best way to get a teenager to read a book is to ban it. The other part of me says that this is part of this discussion that we are having in this country about how to treat race as a very serious and necessary topic for discussion in every platform. Maybe not so much in first, second, third grade, but certainly by the time you're a high school senior, you should be involved in that discussion.
Well, I'm going to have to get the final break of the show, and we have a lot more to talk about. But I'm glad we got to talk to Ralston. I know there are people who listen to Ralston and they think he's not really giving us the kind of very specific direct answers we want. But Jim, over the years, you and I have learned that we have to read the signals and take away what we can from somebody like that, right?
Right, right. And if I tell you what, I know you're the boss, you're in charge of this program. I sure would like to talk about the Georgia Faith and Freedom meeting near the Capitol last week.
That's exactly what we're going to talk about next, Mr. Galloway. But as we go to break, I want to say if one of the things that this Georgia legislature might take up this session is banning the teaching of materials that make students uncomfortable in some way, I would like to vote for algebra and solid geometry to be on that list. This is Political Rewind. We'll be right back. Jim Galloway, two notable stories at least came out of Ralph Reed's Faith and Freedom Coalition conference yesterday in downtown Atlanta. First, Brian Kemp, David Perdue, others spoke. One of the things that came out of it was that in a very crowded room where the photographs I saw showed virtually no one wearing masks, David Perdue, after leaving that conference, his campaign said he had tested positive for COVID-19 and is now in quarantine. So, number one, it'll be interesting to see whether others are, positive after that event yesterday. But more to the point, Jim, and I think this is what you wanted to get at, was the difference between the reception that Perdue got from this conservative Christian, important Christian conservative organization led by George's own Ralph Reed, the difference between how they greeted Kemp and how they greeted Perdue. Jim?
Yeah, and it's just a little bit more background. I mean, Ralph Reed was one of President Donald Trump's just biggest supporters when it came to keeping evangelicals in his camp. And he was out front, very very much out front today, introducing Brian Kemp. And it appears, I would say, the crowd was very much with him. To me, you've got to take that as a signal that maybe the Trump grip on Georgia isn't quite as strong as we might have thought it was, or maybe it's weakened over the last couple months as people really come to understand what that bodes for the GOP here. Ralph introduced Kemp, and he introduced Herschel Walker, if I'm not mistaken. That you give Herschel, but Herschel also has not just the support of Trump; he has the support of Mitch McConnell, the Senate minority leader. So that may be a reason there.
Greg Bluestein reported today that when Perdue got up to speak and gave his reasons why he thought it was important to take on Brian Kemp in a primary, Bluestein's word for the response was a smattering of applause. That does not bode well for David Perdue, certainly with this crowd.
No, look, and if you're holding a kind of a meeting or a rally or something like that, during the legislative session, you are getting you have an audience of very astute political people. These aren't your average voters. They understand exactly what this poses. David Ralston in the early segment of the show very much spelled this out, that there is no way that a Perdue challenge to Brian Kemp can do any good for the party's effort to stay in control of the state capitol.
I thought another reason to say that Ralston came very close to just going ahead and endorsing Brian Kemp. One of the things about that Kemp-Perdue race, though, Jim, that I'm interested in seeing, and maybe the Faith and Freedom Coalition in some ways gave us the first signal of this, is it's certainly not surprising to hear prominent Republicans who have said, why is David Perdue breaking up the party? Kemp has done a good job. But what we're not hearing from, and that would lead us perhaps to believe momentum is moving in Brian Kemp's direction, but there's that vast, vast contingency of Republicans who remain pro-Trump, the voters out there, and their voices are not heard, as the stories are told very often in the news cycle.
Yeah, and this is even if the Perdue challenge wanes. And you got he's campaigning under quarantine right now via video. Remember that this is exactly what happened to him in the final weeks of the general election campaign last year. So there's that. But even if just the mere presence of Perdue pulls Brian Kemp over to the right, it keeps him from addressing those suburban female voters that Speaker Ralston talked about, and it was very interesting that one of the more extended compliments that Ralph Reed gave Brian Kemp was that he did that the governor had not moved toward the middle, that he had that he had stuck to the right. So and when you do that, you do give Stacey Abrams on the Democratic side some maneuvering.
Absolutely. Let's not completely forget about Herschel Walker's moment, because as you pointed out, Ralph Reed introduced Herschel Walker, sat with Herschel Walker, and after apparently, again, according to Bluestein's reporting, right after Gary Black, who was trying to find some way to be competitive with Herschel Walker in that Senate race, gave his speech, Ralph Reed introduced Herschel Walker, which comes as close to an endorsement as you could ask for in that race as well.
Right, right. And that's going to be, there are three really divisive races going on the Republican right side, on the Republican side. Of course, you got the governor's race. That's probably the most important. The secondary is the Herschel Walker contest, which has, you know, you've got three other very good, very qualified Republican candidates in that contest, in two in addition to Gary Black, and you have the Secretary of State's office, you have Brad Raffensperger trying to hold on to his office, hold on to his job when you've got, but you've got Jody Heiss with Trump's endorsement looming out there.
By the way, we're hearing that there have been reports lately that Democrats have started shifting some of their fundraising to Secretary of State races in a number of states, because, in fact, they see that's going to be a crucial battleground. It'll be interesting to see how they weigh in on the Georgia race. And I really don't know the information yet on what we're likely to see from national Democratic organizations giving money to a Democrat who ends up getting the nomination.
It's a little bit uncertain about what the situation in Georgia would be, because last year's changes to the Georgia election law stripped the Secretary of State of a lot of authority that he has over elections.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's turn to Newt Gingrich, former Georgian, of course. He was on Fox News over the weekend, and he had a warning for the Democrats, especially the Democrats on the January 6th committee. He said this: you're going to have a Republican majority in the House and a Republican majority in the Senate, and all of these people who have been so tough and so mean and so nasty are going to be delivered subpoenas. He added that lawmakers are just running over the law on that commission, that committee. And I think when you have a Republican Congress, he said, this is all going to come crashing down, and the wolves are going to find out they are now sheep. And they are the ones who are going to face a real risk, I think, of jail for the kind of laws they are breaking. I'm not aware of any law that's being broken by the House Commission on January 6th.
No, and I will tell you what: when you have worries about the state of our democracy, with a small d, this is one of those moments, because this is, you've seen this in other countries that have been drifting toward drift toward autocracy, and that is when the jailing of one's political opponents becomes commonplace, or at least a common topic. That puts a great strain on the democratic process.
Well, and we have another story in the news over the last couple of days. The FBI arrested a Texas man Friday, alleging he threatened to shoot and kill Georgia election officials on the day before the riot at the U.S. Capitol. It's the first criminal case brought by the new U.S. Justice Department task force aimed at cracking down on threats of violence against election workers. The guy's name is Chad Stark. He wrote on Craigslist, our duty as American patriots put an end to the lives of these traitors and take back our country by force. They withheld the names of the actual election workers who he was planning to target. But boy, there's another disturbing incident to talk about.
Right, and it does answer one question, and that is on January 6th, you had a real step up, or after on the 7th and such, you had a very big increase in security around our state capital in Atlanta, with mm-hmm. with many officers toting long guns, something you didn't in any other
exactly.
situation.
Exactly. But we also have the fencing that caused so much controversy when it was announced that it was going to go up. I mean, maybe we should be thinking about whether it turns out to be important or not. We are out of time, Jim Galloway, a packed show, and I'm really glad you could be here to share it with me, Mr. Galloway. We're going to be back with you, of course, again for another Political Rewind tomorrow. In the meantime, thank you, Jesse Neiswanger, Sam Burmistawes, Natalie Mendenhall, for all of your work on Political Rewind. And thank you all out there, as always, for listening to our show. So until I see you tomorrow, take care. Please stay healthy. Yes, wear your mask. Omicron is still out there and raging. And go get that booster shot and maybe figure out how to pick up one of those free N95 masks the federal government is sending out. See you all tomorrow.